subject at the bottom, and I didn't notice that until after I finished the talk. So this is more phenomenologically oriented than it is theory model building. As Cliff said, actually earlier today, Cliff said, if I'm going to bet on what the LHC is going to see, you think about it because you're betting part of your career on it. And I said, well, many models predict S-channel resonances. So I don't care what model it comes from, but it's a common theme in many models. So that's one of the things I would say there's a high likelihood, although who knows what the form will be. So I'll talk about discovery and identification of an S-channel resonance at the LHC. And actually, I'll give some overview, but I'm going to concentrate on Z primes, ones that come from models with.
You used the word highly. You said highly likely.
Yeah.
Well, as opposed to likely.
Oh, very likely.
Well, very likely. I mean, this shows your prejudice.
Yeah.
If you want to bet against you.
Okay. I mean, whenever you're doing any of this stuff, you're making, I would hope, if you're going to devote years of your life for some calculations, there's only so many, you only have so much time, so you have to make decisions about what you think is going to work out. I don't want to spend time on something that I don't think is going to be relevant.
Right.
I'm probably going to be wrong. Probably most of us will be wrong, but.
But you're betting already the most valuable thing you have, which is your time.
Okay? Yeah. Okay, so a quick outline is to, I'm going to start with a brief overview of models of physics beyond the standard model. Now, this is not in depth. It's really just a survey to illustrate that there are many models that predict these sorts of particles. Then I'll look at the discovery reach of the Z prime of the LHC. And what I really want to concentrate on is identification of the Z prime of the LHC. And the using third generation fermions is something I've been working on with a student of mine. So that would be the new work. And if anybody's interested, there have been a number of reviews on Z primes over the years. There's a nice one by Tom Rizzo. I guess he gave it at lectures at TASI. Art Light, he gave as a physics review. And then Miriam Stadich and I wrote a review years ago, which still seems to be relevant for a DPF study. Okay, so why new physics at GEV? Now, this could be a whole topic on its own. But the conclusion is that we believe the standard model is just a low energy effective theory. It's not a fundamental theory. And because of that, we expect some form of new physics to exist beyond the standard model. We don't really know what it is. I mean, there's a lot of prejudices in the community. If I were to say this, I mean, there's some people that consider the standard model the really minimal supersymmetric standard model, not just the SM. So what we really need is experiments to show the way. And experiments in the near future will be the Large Hadron Collider. So there are many, many models of new physics, and here's just some subset. One is extended gate sectors. So you have extra U1 factors, and that will lead to extra neutral gauge bosons. Within that, you have left-right symmetric model. There's a little Higgs model, which was fairly new and has been fairly popular. And I'll talk a little bit about that. There's theories of extra finite size extra dimensions, and they lead to include the Klein excitations or different types of these things. Then you have supersymmetry, supersymmetric guts, technicolor top color, there's unparticles, and on and on and on. There's many models from physics. So the question is, how do we discover the new physics? And once we discover it, how do we figure out what it came from? So there's a number of possible routes we can take. We can have a direct discovery. You just discover something brand new, and you know what it is. You can have indirect discovery assuming a specific model. And by that, I mean you're looking for subtle effects in precision measurements, for example. So I take my favorite model, and then I look at the implications on some measurement. And then I look for deviations from the standard model. And in a more general form is you can use effective Lagrangian. So you don't put in a specific model, but you can parameterize. You start out with the symmetries of the standard model and write effective operators. They have coefficients. And you can see how those coefficients are constrained by the existing measurements. And if you have a model, you can, in principle, calculate what those, the predictions of the model for those specific coefficients. But that's a bit more indirect, so there are various degrees of how to go about doing this. So by concentrating on direct measurements, you can, maybe possibly the clearest is you just produce exotic particles. I don't know what if anybody thinks about, you know, theories, but you can have excited leptons, excited quarks, leptoquarks, bileptons, you know, whatever. Another one is you can look for in specific channels and looking for resonances, and that would be the difermion channel, which is fairly clear. You can look for anomalous couplings of very standard model particles. So for a while, measuring anomalous gauge boson couplings is a very hot topic. And you look different theories of new physics, you have loop corrections. They would give you deviations from the standard model. And for a long time, people would try to put constraints on these vertices, which would put constraints in the new theories. And likewise, you can do the same thing with fermion couplings. And finally, something that seems to be getting a lot more attention now is to put constraints on Higgs couplings. And I'll allude to that a bit later, although that's not the topic of what I'm covering, but I can get. So to sort out the different models, we have to elucidate and complete the TV particle spectrum. So as I said, there's all sorts of new particles in that are predicted by these models. You have extra gauge bosons, as I mentioned, vector resonances. So a vector resonance of anybody, you know, in technicolor theories, you have techniquarks and they bind together. The technopions are the goldstone, take the place of the goldstone bosons. But you also have things like technorodes, so that's a type of vector resonance. You can have new fermions. You can have, there's no reason why we should restrict ourselves to one Higgs doublet. But on top of that, in models like little Higgs models, there are expanded Higgs sectors. Etc. Okay, so if I look at a lot of these models, as commenting to John, what do all these models have in common? And almost all of them predict a new S-channel structure TEV scale, either from an extended gauge boson or from some sort of new resonance. So how do we distinguish between these models? Okay, so what I'm going to, that's what I'll be really talking about. I'm going to start with a really brief survey of some of these models. I'm just going to look at some of the predictions. This is not a theoretical talk. It's really just touching upon different aspects that I want to come back to later. So I'm going to start with quite a superficial overview of some of these recent models that people have looked at, or not so recent, too. The extended gauge theories, that's the simplest. They've been around the longest. In some guises, they're grand unified theories. These effective rank 5 models, looking at the age of people in the room, I think at least John would remember this. In the mid-80s, when they had the first superstring revolution, one of the predictions was that only exceptional gauge groups would satisfy these superstring symmetries. So in that, they had E6 and E8. So E6 became one of the possible ways, predictions of superstring theories. I mean, it's a bit of a stretch, but people spent a lot of time studying it. So you have the symmetry breakdown of E6 going to an SO10 crosses U1, and the SO10 breaks down to a SU5 and a U1, and eventually you get a standard model with this extra U1. And the theta E6 is because the U1 chi and the U1 psi, they can mix together. You can get linear combinations, so then the couplings of the Z prime would be a linear combination of the couplings of these two U1s. And actually, that's the linear combination below. Left-right symmetric models.
Did these fall out of favor? Because I don't really hear about E6s anymore. I hear about E8s.
From the string point of view, I don't have a clue. From the phenomenology, if you look at phenomenology papers, and I'm going to show you some plots later that are, you know, pretty recent. Actually, and people still use these as benchmarks. If you look in the particle data group for searches for C primes, they'll put discovery limits on various E6 C primes. So from a theoretical point of view, I have no idea. From a phenomenological point of view, there's still people use them as benchmark particles to search for.
I think the problem is they still are well motivated, but you can never solve the modulus stabilization problem there. People made progress on that somewhere else. So more modern, more recent kind of there where you can now address this.
And is there well a reason you can't solve?
It's just generically hard to do, and just the amazing thing was they were able to solve it. The flux stabilizations, they have more fluxes available in type 2B back than are in Iraq. These are all Iraq back.
Okay.
That brings me back memories. Okay, so the left-right symmetric model, some people would take the view that why is parity violated? If you go to some higher energy scale, maybe parity is restored. So that's the motivation for that. So again, you have, when you break it down, you get extra factors. And the couplings are given by this messy expression. Now I'm taking the Harvard model, sometimes called the ununified model, as representative. So in this model, you have one SQ2 for the leptons and another SQ2 for the quarks, and then it breaks and you get a mixing. So you get the standard model Z0, and then you get a Z prime. Now I said that generically because there are other versions of this that you have the light quarks, where the first two generations will be a light SU2, and then there's another SU2 coupling to the third generation. So there are many variations of that. The point is simply that there are many models that have these particles in them. Okay, the little Higgs caused a bit of a revolution, and I know somebody at lunch or coffee didn't like it, but I actually sort of like this from a phenomenological point of view. Some people don't, maybe for aesthetic reasons, because what they're doing is they're taking the stuff we don't know, the TeV scale, and pushing it up to 10 TeV, so they're brushing it under the rug, and then they call it UV completion. So in this, you start out with a high scale, you have a global symmetry, and then you somehow break it. And that gives rise to a lot of pseudo-Goldstone bosons, and you gave some subgroup of that global symmetries, which gives results in some. I'll get the hockey stick out here. It gives rise to some extra gauge bosons. It also the model puts in some heavy top quark like fermions, and when you work through all the symmetries, it cancels the quadratic. Both of these cancel the quadratic divergences, you get to the Higgs mass in the standard model. And then eventually you get down to the light, the standard model particles.
What do you mean by light Higgs?
The standard model type of Higgs.
So it's between. The Tavitron is busy excluding it.
In agreement with central aggregated.
Yeah. Which is the usual one.
Between 115 and 146 or something.
I'll say generically that. Okay.
So, but these models did have a Z prime, right? You're talking about Z
prime. Yeah, yeah. The ZH would be a Z prime.
And that really excluded them to a large degree. I mean, that's why people started to do all these perturbations on the original model. Are you talking about the original model here, or which you're talking about this as a class of models?
Yeah, I'm talking about as a class.
Okay. So with T parity, or?
No. Just generic, you know, class of things.
You kind of need T parity for a number of reasons, which I'm sure you know, right? And the Z prime you really want to get rid of because the Tevatron has really kind of pushed it out of existence.
What's the dog on it?
Why?
It was enough to, even when his paper came out, like within a year, Peskin wrote the paper saying that they had to switch to the SU2U1 model, which didn't have a Z prime, which is for the exact reason. I can't remember what it was.
But
even like 5 years ago, the Tevatron was pushing the Z prime like this would have. The original NEMA model.
Okay, that
that's why they perturbed into the SQ2SQ1.
Okay.
And then it became like, you know, the
same.
There's valid models. But.
Anyway, I'm talking about generically because there's a whole pile of them and I don't remember which is which. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to get off too much of a tangent, but I'm.
But if it does have a Z prime,
my understanding was that these things predicted them to be fairly high mass. The problem wasn't that it'd be so low mass they'd be excluded,
kind of,
it would be too high to be observed.
there's somewhat high mass, but then there's like a 1/20 that comes in. We actually work out, I did a paper on this in the summer, so
okay.
This is familiar to me. So we actually work out the mass of these compared to the other suitable bosons, and C prime actually gets like just this numerical, it isn't that heavy, it's like 1 TB-ish. So, and that's already right now being constrained by, that was even 5 years ago being constrained by Tetrahedron. So you want to avoid the Z prime, basically.
Well, in this particular one, though.
Yeah.
Okay,
but can I ask just, where does the scale 10 dB come from in these models, or is it relevant to any of this discussion?
No.
It's not really.
It's not relevant to the point. I'm just really using to motivate different types of, I'm more interested in the phenomenology, and this is part of the rationale why this phenomenology is interesting.
It's 4 pi F. F is 1 TeV.
I see.
Yeah.
The 10 is 4 pi.
Okay. Yeah, the F is the Goldstone boson.
Sure, yeah.
The K-plus scale, and it's just 4 pi.
Okay, so extra dimensions. So that's another scenario that people have talked about that gives rise to extra gauge bosons. In this context, they're Kaluza-Kine towers. But a lot of these models really depends on the geometry of the extra dimensions, and there are many variations on this too. And
it turns out not to be true that for colliders, you're sensitive to the very highest frequency modes because it's only because you've got so much phase space that you see anything at all. And the very high frequency modes don't know the difference between a torus or a sphere or whatever the dimensions are. They just basically count the dimensions. It's the things like Newton's law that cares about the shape of the extra dimensions, where you're looking at the lowest of the Planck states.
But like a UED model where you have TV sized dimensions.
Depends on how big they are,
That's
or warp dimension, that would be different too.
That's what you think.
Yeah.
I think you're right. If you're at the weak scale and you are looking at the lowest, you're looking at the lowest states.
Not sure. Okay, I was going to actually delete this, but because it's not so relevant, because they don't really predict the type of resonances we're interested here. Basically, you get a continuous spectrum, so you can include it as an effective operator, and you get deviations. So in our case, we could have had deviations from the two jet cross sections, but they're very hard to distinguish from the standard model, so it's not so relevant. It predicts these other objects which can mix with the Higgs. So that's another example of getting deviations from the standard model predictions for Higgs particles. Okay, the one that's a bit more relevant is a Randall-Sundrum model that you have the brains that are separated. And here it does depend on the geometry. So from our point of view, what we're really interested in, I have some stuff that, I said I would allude to this later on. So you get the fluctuations of this size corresponds to a radion, and that connects with the Higgs boson. And again, it's yet another example about how they can alter the branching ratios for the Higgs boson. So these sorts of precision measure, if they can do it, these measurements can be a sensitive test for some of these different models. What I was more interested in is that in these Randall-Sundrum models, you predict Kaluza-Kine excitations, and particularly you have gravitons, and they're predicted TEE scales. There are a couple of parameters here, the coupling strength of the graviton, and then the mass of the first state, and then you can generate different spectra. Yeah.
If you do something puzzling, if you calculate the cross section of graviton scattering, it's 10 to the minus 66 centimeters squared.
These are strongly coupled, but these are much more strong.
So how are you producing this graviton resonance that can be seen?
These
coupled with the weak interaction strength.
So the graviton is coupled to the Higgs.
These are not the normal graphs. These are the KK graphs.
In this specific model, and he was telling me, well, I've seen this, but he's the expert on this because it depends how they couple the different brains, and you get different couplings. Okay, then this other one, now I don't know of anybody in the room. I'm not sure the point of this. It was created by Appelquist and Company. And this model is just sort of almost to be subversive, that you have all the standard model particles propagating in the bulk, and then you get this Kaluza-Klein towers of standard model particles with spin quantum numbers identical to the standard model. So the key is that the spectrum resembles that of SUSY. And the reason I wonder if it's being subversive, because Appelquist has always worked on dynamical symmetry breaking models. He hasn't been keen on SUSY, and it's almost like, did he invent this model to demonstrate that just because you see a certain decay chain, you can't conclude that it's SUSY, that it is something else. And there have been some other models recently that people have looked at from the same point of view, but I don't remember what it was.
Even little Higgs models can talk.
Maybe that was what it was. There's something fairly, I don't remember what
people
it was.
People write papers, writing papers recently about trying to distinguish universal extra dimensions, little Higgs models, the SUSY, and it's a tough business.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I only mention it because and there's this view that, you know, SUSY, if you see certain things, you discover SUSY and you understand everything. And there are counterexamples, it's not so simple. And what you have to do is do these elaborate spin analysis to really figure out details of the spectrum.
The basic point is you need partners in all cases to cancel things like the quadratic convergences. So those partners will exist, they'll have different spin, but you can't really tell the spin of LHC. But kind of the basic idea as to why the pattern of signals is similar.
Yeah.
But if you always get a T prime and all this sort of thing, whatever.
Okay. So an S-channel structure of the TEV scale appears in many of these models. It can appear in these string and spire models. That is these D6 models, extended gauge sectors. I didn't really talk so much about them except in this context. Left-right symmetric models, little Higgs models, these Kaluza-Klein excitations. You can also get scalars, so you can have an extended Higgs sector, so you might get Higgs boson type things. These radions, graphs, scalars, and even a SUSY neutralino, and finally, like these higher spin states, gravitons. And I never mentioned this before, string resonances, some people have worked out. So there's a lot of these things appear in a lot of different places. So the question is, you know, how do you distinguish between the models? So, first thing is, how do you produce a Z prime? So now I'm going to restrict myself to not all of them, but just specifically a Z prime. So you have your protons coming in, the quarks and the anti-quark in them annihilate to a photon C0 Z prime into a fermion, a difermion final state pair. You write a differential cross-section, which is a function of the rapidity, invariant mass, and this is a center, the scattering angle and the center mass of the collision. So, written in this expression, the model-dependent stuff is in this S in A terms, so that's here. So here you have the propagator from, I've only included the Z prime contribution here, but you should normally sum over all the contributions from the photon and the Z zero. And you have the couplings. And then the Gs are functions of the parton distribution function, so they're model-independent. It's a standard model of QCD.
So how many parameters is the four of them in there?
You mean here?
Four coupling there?
I have four contributing, but you have, depending on how you count it, you'll have a left-handed quark, a left-handed fermion, a left-handed lepton.
So what and then are each species?
Yeah, so you have five left and five right. No, sorry, five total.
Why don't these models violate three-level unitarity? Because you have a cross-channel.
I'm going to give you the simple, if they're all gauge invariant models.
The Higgs models, the window dressing of the Higgs models, so if you put in the Higgs particle,
right,
you cancel any unitarity violation of the TEV.
Right.
And it's not just it's not the gauge invariance that's doing it.
Well, it's part of that, yeah.
There could be other particles that come in to restore unitarity.
This is a very tricky business.
Yeah, I think linearly realized gauge inverters to do it. So if he's got a linearly realized gauge,
well, to give these things mass, you have to have heat stack for it. I don't.
Take away the heat, it's still gauge inverter.
You're just not looking at it.
You break the same.
Yeah.
So that's not the experience.
These models in particular, it's never been an issue. There's a model I'm going to mention that it isn't, that one will have problems with it.
This is like drill yen, right?
It's drill yen, but he's the same. I have, he's not talking about drill yen. Well, I guess you, if I put a T-channel in there.
But just it's not relevant to the level you're
missing.
No, not relevant for this thing at all.
You work on the scattering aperture.
If you truly
hate it. The WW scratching.
Yeah, we're not.
And you put in all these particles, and they all have to cancel out. So you pull them out of your turn. It's a very tricky business.
Well, you could construct a model where you can turn it on violet, right?
Has anybody done that?
I'm pretty sure, but
I'm trying to run through the simple thing.
I'm pretty sure this is okay, but
just that new you want, just a new case that would not violate unitary. That's an example that would do it.
Even if it did violate unitary, it'd be at some high scale, and this is all going to be embedded in some other high scale. So, I don't think it matters for his signal at all.
I think it's better than that because I know there are other models that we looked at that can constrain the models using unitarity where it violates unitarity, but in these it's never been an issue.
Does anyone check the little speak model where it violates the charge? You have to do an explicit calculation.
I don't.
I know how to do this.
Yeah, but I think that you're asking a harder question. One way in which people have checked it would be all he has to do is make a model with the Higgs in it that gives the mass, it's normalizable engaging variant, and then he knows the unitary is going to work. So then your question then would become, how do you know that the Higgs is not complicating your signal? But I think the claim is that it doesn't in this case.
No, it doesn't.
The middle Higgs models are explicitly cut, but they're explicitly an effective field theory that has a cutoff. So
as long as it doesn't violate unitary at that scale.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they will violate unitary at some scale, but it'll be around the 10 TeV scale.
I'm not even sure.
All sounds very contrived. Sorry.
That's our job.
Thank you. Some data forces us to do.
Okay, so if we plug that equation, if we calculate it and take a specific example of a Z prime 1.5 TeV, and I have some, this is going to mu plus mu minus final state, these particular cross sections. I put a cut on the PT of the outgoing muons and a rapidity cut on the outgoing muons. And the point here is just to show that you get different distributions for the different models. And I'm going to come back to this a little bit because the shape of these distributions is one method you can use to distinguish between models. Okay, so when I started out, I wanted to use this to look at discovery limits. So we have a cross section. Now, we can simplify this a little bit. We integrate both the invariant mass into these. Z primes are narrow enough, you can apply the narrow width approximation and then and integrate over the angles. You can simplify the cross section. It's a function of rapidity. Okay, so
this is the best case scenario, right? If you wanted the LHC to see something immediately, this is the way to see it.
Anything at all or just Z primes?
If he said God is the most benevolent God that could possibly be there and is going to give something to the LHC, which will be the easiest thing that we could all see.
I think this is the easiest thing.
This is the easiest thing.
So I think the Higgs would be more, everybody's looking for, but it's hard to see.
This is just a scan, they see a bump, and then they have to interpret it. As long as another bump is there, they have to interpret it.
Because it's a dead simple thing. You have two, The cross sections are such, the standard model cross section, you have a mu plus mu minus final state. It has a really clean signal. You just got these back to back muons. If you get a few events, later on, what I'm going to do from limiting, putting discovery limits, I'm going to take 10 events. But in fact, if you see three events, theorists are going to go crazy already. So, it's close to that, be pretty. Probably the cleanest signal they can see.
It has muons, so you're going to tag it, right? So and it's acceptable.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to think.
See it.
Yeah. So I can't think of anything easier.
Are you saying those are going to be resolvable? We're not seeing that.
Sorry, what do you mean?
Those different curves.
Oh, if you have, I'll show you something in a minute because I will look at that. I haven't put error bars on this, so I can say, yeah, it's going to be resolvable for sure. Mm-hmm. Right? I didn't tell you what sort of integrated luminosity you need to resolve it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a bit of a cheat, I guess. So
I'm used to being cheated.
Okay. Okay, so I mean these are different plots calculated for different models by the Atlas collaboration. Here they're looking at Kaluza Klein, and there's something to do with how you embed the models. So they have you get different interference, so you get different cross sections. So are off the peak, and then for the little Higgs model, again you have a parameter and just examples done by is Georges Wallis, who's at the University of Montreal. He's an experimentalist who does a lot of this stuff. I guess he's also the head of the exotics particles group for Atlas. Okay, so how do you do it? Well, you take that cross-section expression, you can calculate cross-section as a function of the Z prime mass. And let's say we want 10 events, 5 events in a mu plus u minus channel, 5 events in a e plus u minus channel. So if we have one inverse femtobarn, we can multiply the one inverse femtobarn by the cross section, and we go across here, and this is 10 events. And we just go down, and we see that 10 events corresponds to about 2.8 TeV for the psi model, for the chi model, it's 10 events correspond, that one inverse femtobarn is about 2.4 TeV. If you go now to 10 inverse femtobarns, you need a lot less, a smaller cross section, so it goes up to 4 TeV. So what you can do is you can plot if you have some selection criteria like 10 events, you can see how much integrated luminosity you need to get 10 events, and you can make plots for these different models, and you just read off. So. Just check this out. I'll come back to this in a minute when I show you some other plots that we expect. So you can take, convert that into a plot of luminosity required to discover the Z prime with a certain mass, and you then can read it off for given integrated luminosities to see the discovery reach. And typically for a Z prime of the LHC, it's about 4 or 5 TeV in the model. And the procedure I just described is real. And years ago, I made predictions for the Tevatron for given integrated luminosities, and sort of nice that actually when they do these experiments, they get the limits that I said they would. So that's what they do. This is a CDF plot. Select two opposite high PT leptons. Look at the invariant mass distribution. So the dots are data. The line that goes through there is Monte Carlo. So what they're looking for is bumps somewhere. So if you have events in a bin, like that's one. So you see that if you have three events, it would be a big deal. And then they can convert that, if we're looking at spin one object, they can convert this into confidence levels on the cross section. And you can see where the Z prime cross section intercepts the limits to get just limits on Z prime with different models. Okay, John's back. John was going on about unitarity, and we're responding with gauge invariance. So actually, the sequential standard model is something. What they do is they throw in a Z prime, which has the same couplings as the standard model Z prime, and that's really not gauge invariant, but it uses a standard candle when comparing results. So it's used a lot just to compare things, but it's really not a realistic model. So you can take, for example, that plot and do what we said, and you can put constraints on the parameter space. So in the little Higgs model, you have these two Z prime-like objects, and you can see how they, you can exclude a large area of parameter space. Oh, I just threw this in for completeness. So I'm talking about C primes, but you get similar things with W primes. The difference is that you have a neutrino that's missing. So you calculate something called a transverse mass. So you look at the four vectors perpendicular to the beam direction, calculate this invariant mass. And because it's losing information, you don't get a nice peak. But when you hit the kinematic limit for the thing, you can see the shape gives you, demonstrate that you found something with the W prime. So the input here was, I think, yeah, it's 2 TeV. You can see that the phase space cuts off there.
How is this being calculated? This is an event generator of some sort?
Yeah, this was, it was George's WALA, so we probably put it through the FAST Atlas detector simulator, which I'm told people, I'm not sure everybody trusts that so much, but that's how he's done it. Okay, and again, you can look at these gravitons, and you know, get a spectrum, and you can get a parameter space of interest in different luminosities. You can rule out different parts of the parameter space. So 100 inverse femtoparticles is the 1 year of design luminosity for the LHC, so it can basically exclude all this parameter space.
How much are they going to get in the... that was what the design was, but what are they likely to get?
Oh, okay, I'll get to that in the next slide, okay? So I have our, this is our, actually my graduate student produced these plots for 14 TeV, and also this is for 10 TeV. So, it's up there. Okay, so Cliff was asking me, what do they expect in the first year, and I asked a member of one of my colleagues on the Atlas collaboration this yesterday. They're going to run, you know, they've had problems, everybody knows they've had problems, so they're going to basically run for a full year. Normally they shut down in the winter because electricity is really expensive, but they want to make up time, so they're going to run through the winter. So I've heard originally it's going to be like, they figure 10 inverse picobar. Yeah, that's right, 10 inverse picobars for some period. And I thought they would get up to 100 inverse picobars for the first year, but actually Gerald Oakey said the plan is, the latest thing he just got was a expect to get 200 inverse picobars the first year of running. So that would be the axis. So my, what I'm doing is I'm going through these luminosity versus discovery reach. So the initial period, I don't know how long it is. I don't know the running schedule. I don't have the running schedule. Basically, you have these sorts of arrows corresponding to these different models. These vertical lines are the existing limits. So let's just take the chi model for example. So the chi model is, the existing limit is here. Initially, this is as well as they can do, so they aren't going to actually even compete with the tethertron. But at 100 inverse picobarns, we can go along here, go down, and they can actually beat the tethertron by a couple of 300 GeV. And actually, if I go down here, it's where I should have. After a year, they're going to get up to about 1,200 for this particular model.
Okay, so tethertron runs up to 2 TeV. So they're up to 3 to 5 inverse femtoparticles now. And they expect themselves to be up to 10 inverse femtoparticles.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they've never seen anything new. The tethertron.
Yeah, the production cross sections are different.
Sorry?
The tethertron has not observed any new particles.
That's right.
The Higgs.
Yeah.
And they're running, they expect within the next year to run at 10 inverse femtoparticles.
Right.
Luminosity up to 2 TeV.
Yeah.
So we can, they're already going to make a decision within 3 seconds on what's going on before the LHC turns on.
Well, if the tethertron runs, I don't know what the plots are. I mean, it's something you can calculate pretty quickly. But if you take the tethertron cross sections, because you can't use these curves, if they double the luminosity, the, you know, I don't know how, I forget, I just don't remember how much it increases reach. It'll increase it somewhat, but it won't be, it will be less than the LAC if the LAC does a 200 inverse picobars per sphere.
Are you thinking that they can beat the LAC? Is that...
Yeah, because 100 inverse picobars is 0.1 inverse rate.
This is higher than
1,000. So the story on the block size says that within 2011, they can beat up the LAC.
That's depending on what you're looking for.
That's for the Higgs.
You're thinking of the Higgs.
Well, this is, we're looking here at 900 GeV or so.
No, but it's a bit more subtle because if you're looking for the Higgs, I mean, for this, I have to look at the cross sections. For the Higgs, part of it's whether you can actually detect it or not, right? And there's windows of detection, and right, they have the upper part.
And it's light, so you know there's not a kinematic problem.
Yeah,
so
it's.
Whereas here, he's getting a bound on the mass of this thing, so that there's a premium of having more energy. They have a far greater reach.
Yeah. So the Higgs, they're looking at a lower, they're trying to close a small, lower energy mass window.
The latest as of last week is that they've excluded 150.
Right, right. Yeah, but all they're doing is the Kapitron has excluded a small window around 160 GeV. But there's still this big gap between 100 and something and 160. So by increasing the luminosity, they increase the event rate and maybe fill in some of those holes. But that's for the Higgs, whereas the LHC, we're going to a high energy, off filling up a lower hole. So it's different physics and different. It's not so much the detector, it's just for the Higgs, the signal depends on the mass, because it depends on what it can decay into. Whereas this thing is just a simple, it's straightforward B plus B minus final pair that they're looking for. So there's not the same issue at all.
So if you could turn it around with the International Linear Collider, you could have E plus E minus going into, but this is not going to happen. The best way to see the resonances is to use an E plus E minus collider.
You know where it is.
If only if you have the energy. Let's just say hypothetically that the LHC discovers a Z prime at, let's say, 4 TeV. You're not going to build an E plus E minus collider that goes to 4 TeV. So you're going to have to look at the properties through indirect measurements, not a direct one. Anyway, that's a different subject. I have some pretty plots for that one. But, okay, so just to summarize everything, you have the electroweak bounds from precision measurements. You have E plus E minus, so that's what you were alluding to, looking for deviation from standard model cross sections and observables. The tetratron limits, and all this stuff came out of part of the data book. And these are limits for 100 inverse femtobars predicted for the LHC.
Okay, so wait. So that's the tetratron limit.
This is the existing tetratron limit. Actually, this is from the PEG, so it's 2008. I don't know if it's gone up since it was published.
But with the numbers I'm looking at, that's the mass limit, or what is that?
Yeah.
That's a 95% confidence level exclusion.
Yes, it might be 90%, but
it's going up. Since
then. Yeah, because they're getting data like crazy. But yeah,
yeah, but they have to analyze it. Right?
Yeah,
I don't know if it's published.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I think I got this stuff from the summer conferences.
So they're around a TV.
Yeah, I remember seeing. These numbers came from the summer conferences last year, and unless there was something in the last month. It's generally a safer conferences. I haven't seen any papers.
But it's really model. Like these are, so they consider maybe five benchmark models, and but really you have, like you said, five parameters, six parameters for each.
Yeah, these are just some benchmark models.
So the limits are pretty. They're very model dependent.
Yeah, exactly, for sure. Okay, so let's say the LHC discovers an S-channel resonance, Eureka. John remembers where this came from? No? Okay, I'll tell you after. So the question is, what is it? Many possibilities exist, as I pointed out. You know, Z prime, some little Higgs models, gravitons, KK excitations, etc. So let's assume that the LHC discovers a single rather heavy resonance, and what is it? So you have a bunch of tools to work with, cross sections and widths, and I'm putting these here because I'm not going to really look at them later. You take the straight cross section, the PP going to Z prime to L, electron pair. It's the cross section that produces Z prime times the branching ratio. You know, there's a very important unknown in any of this. The branching ratio is the partial width to one, that should be minus two, a specific final state divided by the total width. But if the problem with the total width is to calculate it, it depends on the number of particles and Z primes decaying into. So everything I'm doing, I'm assuming only decays into standard molar particles. So if you have extended theories, in principle, there can be other particles. So really, you have to be careful about this. However, if you multiply this cross-section, which you can measure the peak cross-section, times the width, which you can measure, that product cancels it out. So you don't have that uncertainty in it. So that's one input. Another input, I'm just writing it down because, I will come back to it, is a partial width is proportional to the couplings. So you keep on asking about the number of couplings, so you want to have a large number of independent observables to be able to constrain them. You have angular distributions, rapidity distributions, and various other things which to measure the couplings, like polarization. Okay, so I think it was Cliff who asked me this, about invariant mass distribution gives some information. So this is the same plot, and what you see is, I don't have error bars in this, if you can measure, actually none of them, I thought something, if you can measure these cross sections below the peak, you can use that as an additional piece of information to distinguish between the different models. Above the peak, the cross section decreases pretty rapidly, so you probably want the event rate and therefore the statistics to be able to do very well on this.
Can I ask a stupid question?
So if you're nervous, your questions are it's tricky.
Well, okay.
The other problem is
it'll be good. I'll do my best. How are you going to select for the muons that actually correspond to this decay? Because there's going to be other muons used in the decay to actually be able to reproduce this graph here, right? I mean, you need to basically be able to identify the muons that correspond to this particular decay, right?
Well, no, this is an invariant mass distribution. So actually, these plots include all the standard model electrically at tree level, like the photon and the Z0 are in here. So actually,
that are going in here, those muons only come from the standard model plus the Z prime, the particular production process. And there'll be other underlying events and other things producing muons. So you have to be
looking at 5PT muons, and my understanding is that they're pretty distinct. There's very little, you're worried about backgrounds, really.
Yeah.
There are very little backgrounds from the signal. So when Cliff said, you know, is this the easiest thing for them to see? And part of the reason it's the easiest thing for them to see is because if you put the appropriate cuts in, there's virtually no background.
Okay, so this has a cut on the background, which basically zeroes it completely.
Let's say it does, yeah. I always worry if there's something I've missed.
I think you were choosing like a 50.
I use 50, and you can raise it. I mean, but my understanding, if you remember the plot from CDF, they've done exactly what I've done, and it's pretty background free. And everything I've read by the experimentalists doing full simulations is it's pretty much background free. And the 50 GeV is typically what they use, and the rapidity value is typically what they use.
And you're only going to get one IPT muon event. You won't have multiple events of this form or other forms that are not suppressed. Not background, but signal events. Same thing.
There's
a ton of stuff going on. This is a pretty
I'm not sure what you're Are you worried about the fact that you have so many things happening in one crossing?
Yeah.
Well, it's.
So how many Z prime events do you get in a particular
crossing?
Crossing.
I don't know. I would assume less than one because.
That's kind of my mental. I just.
I
is that known? I assume that's part of the case.
Somebody must know it. You can, it isn't too hard to work out, but I haven't. I don't know.
Okay.
It's a sort of.
Yeah, I can count that. There's one. I just want to make sure.
I can ask. I'm going to speak to somebody next week. I'm going to George's waitlist. We can. I can ask him if I can remember, because he's supposed to be more of an authority on this than I, the details than I am. But anytime I've just talked about this to an experimentalist, they haven't worried about it. They all seem to, you know, they think it's reasonable.
Okay.
This is not the sort of event that you have to worry about.
Well, just because it's the easiest thing to see, I would think that its production cross section is high enough that you're going to go, you know.
It's not just that the cross section is, the cross section isn't necessarily all that big.
But the background is
very it's because it's a very clean signal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, muons. You get other sources of muons, but I guess the high PT muons going through the muon chambers, there's not much you can confuse it with. Now, Cliff said, okay, is this the easiest thing? And I sort of think, what are the counterexamples? Well, maybe cosmic ray comes through and isn't,
yeah.
These things aren't bent enough in the magnets. You distinguish between a mu plus and a mu minus, you need some bending. So cosmic rays will have a different behavior. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I should have brought some events, but you know, I think it's really clean. Well, I didn't. Okay. Something to think about. Okay. You can use angular distributions to determine the spin. So let's say you see a peak in the dielectron spectrum. Is it a gauge boson or a random Sundrum inclusive point excitation? So you can use angular distributions, and in this plot, you have three different curves: the spin 2, the spin 0 is the green, and spin 1 is red. So Rizzo generated some data for these things, and I think it's typically 100 inverse femtobarns, and the idea is you can see you can distinguish between the different spins. It's actually not quite as simple. This is from, I think it's Atlas again. A better simulation. So you have different contributions to the graviton. You have the quark annihilation, gluon annihilation, different contributions. And the error bars, you have the predicted cross section and what you get through the Monte Carlo. And then this curve is what you expect from the spin 1. And again, you can distinguish it, but it's not as obvious because there are acceptance issues that Tom doesn't seem to have taken into account. And I think this is probably more reliable. Okay?
This very much confuses me. So
what we want to do is we want to be able to distinguish between the spin 1 and this spin.
Okay, that iteration. Okay, but. So, you can accept universally all z. Is that the idea?
Sorry.
All z that he's got in here. All.
Oh, sorry. The z is post theta. So this is the scattering angle in the center of mass.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a dielectron pair. They boost it back to the center of mass frame, and then look at the angular distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. So I'm gonna. Showed you part of this already. I showed you this part and this part, and I'm going to use some combinations and integrations to get some observables. So I'm going to integrate over the center of mass angle, this cos theta, and I've divided into a forward region and a backward region. So from 0 to 1, from minus 1 to 0, and I have a plus minus corresponding to a d sigma plus minus, which is really forward plus or minus the back. So if you add them together, you're getting the total cross section, and the minus is the difference, which we'll use for forward backward asymmetry. In the narrow width approximation, This integrates to this combination of couplings. So the example is, again, we want to create observables to be able to extract coupling information. Let's see. Okay, so we have a forward-backward asymmetry. This is an AFB. And we take the this difference divided by the sum, and it's equal to this relationship of the combination of couplings. There's a couple of things I want to point out here. First of all, the minus sign. Why is there a minus sign on the rotundity? It's because we're defining it with respect to the detector. But you have two protons coming in, so how do I construct the direction from two protons? Because it's symmetric. But what happens is that you get the quark from one and the anti-quark from the other, but in general, not always, but statistically, the quark has a higher momentum fraction, so the whole thing's boosted in the quark direction. So you can define the quark direction as a plus direction, but that's the rotundity, because everything's boosted that way. So when it has a negative rotundity with respect to the fixed detector, it tells you the quark's coming in the opposite direction. So if you wanted to define in the angular distributions the quark direction as a plus direction, this minus sign compensates when it's coming from the other proton. Okay, the other thing is I'm integrating from 0 to y max, so that is the maximum rotundity that you can measure in the detector. But actually, the 0 isn't quite accurate either, because when the quark and the anti-quark have similar momentums, you really can't distinguish any direction. So in fact, later on we'll take a lower value for this. We won't use 0, we'll use some y min that optimizes this rotundity difference.
Remind me what the plus minus on a cross section is again?
It's a combination between the forward and the backward in the center of mass. Okay. So you can plot the forward backward asymmetry as a function of the invariant mass. This is for a z prime mass of 1.5 TeV. So your 1.5 error bars are very small because you're sitting on the pole. When you get off resonance, you have lower statistics. Error bars are bigger. But anyway, if you look at the forward backward asymmetries for the different models, you can see they have different shapes. And the question is, can you experimentally distinguish it? So again, you can calculate error bars based on the statistics of 100 inverse femtobarns, and you can see you can distinguish between this is using the models, I thought it was the ADA model as input. Use the ADA model, the errors are for an ADA model as input, and you clearly can distinguish between the left, right, or the this chi model. I think, this is CMS basically did at a different point. This is sitting on the resonance. You can distinguish between the different models. Not all the time, though. You can see that for the left, let's say the chi and psi, which you, again, the psi and the eta, which is the green and the blue, they look similar, and likewise, when you take the value on the pole, it's saying the same thing. Okay, back to the rapidity. So I was saying that the parton distribution functions are harder for the UD bars than they are for the DD bars, and they're even higher than the C quark, the Cs, which would be the anti-quarks. So people have used, if you put cuts on different regions, you can emphasize, for example, you put a cut on rapidity of 1, you have a lot more UU bar than you do DE bar. And if you go to a lower rapidity, you have more DD bar than you do UU bar. So people are using this as a discriminator. In different regions, you emphasize different couplings. So if you take the cross-section as a function of rapidity for, again, these different models, they get different, because they have different couplings to UE bar and DD bar, you get different distributions and use that as a discriminator. So, one measure of this is this rapidity ratio where you take the inner divided by the outer. So, the inner here would be in here, and the outer would be out here. And then, what you do is you want to pick the Y1 that sort of optimizes this difference. There are other things that people have played with too. They've taken rapidity distributions and they fit it with an input to try and extract the UE bar and DD bar contributions. So, I'm going way over. How much time do I have
left? We have the room until 2:30, so we should
go. But your patience, too. So.
Well, then it'll all be forced by the cook us out of the room at 2:30.
So. Yeah, or minutes before 2:30.
Okay.
That's the hard cutoff.
Okay, so let me. So, there have been a number of approaches to do combined fits. So, Petriello and Quackenbush took, they created these four combinations. Of couplings, where the Q could be up or down in both cases. They divided the phase space into four regions in rapidity and angle, so you have a forward inner, a backward inner, so the rapidity's in the inner region, and the forward in the center of mass of the scatter, and back in the backward direction. And then they do the same for the outer region. So they have four parameters, they have four regions in the phase space they're fitting to, and they can constrain these parameters. So four-dimensional parameters, and they can project it onto the CU and CD or the EU and ED. And let's see, these dashed ellipses are due to the statistical errors. And dotted are due to the uncertainties in Parkland distribution functions. And then the final outer one is when we combine them quadratically.
So why are they oriented opposite of that? Is that an easy way to see why they're...
No. They have a matrix. They generated stuff and they converted the matrix. I don't know. Yeah. I haven't thought about it.
Must be projecting some basis for the
somehow statistics is a degeneracy, CU, CD, which is...
I don't think you should read too much into it, but it might be a reason, but it's...
just consistent everywhere.
Yeah, no, I know, I see it, but...
it got to be projected.
Okay, and then this...
How do they know the PDF errors?
I thought you did this stuff. How do you know the PDF errors? What they do is people take these sets of PDFs, and it's a whole pile of it. You can. What they do is they do their results. They calculate it using all seven sets or whatever, and they can vary all these different parameters in them, and then you get a range, based on all these different sets, and that's what they use for the uncertainty.
So they have the fit of the lower energy data that they're running up with some DGLAP evolution to some high scale.
Right.
And so they have so each of the different groups have their own different separate fit. Is that right?
Everybody uses CTEC. And CTEC, if you go to the CTEC part-time distributions, they have like different versions of them. And there's stuff you can fiddle with it. And what people do is they fiddle with all of it to see how much it varies, and that's what they use. So, is that true or not? It's sort of it's the best you can do, and it's not unreasonable starting point. I guess you could say that it could be way off.
So I guess the question is, so how much is this fit is just the fact that you can't calculate, people haven't calculated higher order evolution like DGLAP or something, and how much of it is just irreducible uncertainty that is just nothing you can do?
I suspect most of it's irreducible uncertainty that you can't do because, well, no, it can't be because the errors are sort of the same input. I mean, you're doing these fits, right? And then you're doing this extrapolation, but there's errors in the fits. Mm-hmm. And that's irreducible for the time being. Um, It's probably a combination of both because you have the same input. But a lot of it, you know, we were talking about, you know, what really useful physics, and what's going to be the most useful thing people can do is when the first LHC results come out, they use it to calibrate all the PDFs and prove it.
Yeah, that's all of it.
Yeah, but that's useful.
Yeah.
Okay. There are other observables that people have talked about using rare decays. I haven't written down what they are in terms of the couplings. There are problems with this that they base it on statistical errors. So here they have, this is this E6 mole and the mixing angle between it. And they're taking, you're just seeing how the different these different ratios vary as a function of the mixing angle. For one specific model, they can see how you can use it for input. And then you can translate it for the different models, and they give you different points in this parameter space. So it's R nu nu z, which is this one, and R L nu w, which is this one, and they give you points in the parameter space. The problem is that they really didn't do a very sophisticated analysis in the sense they didn't take into account anything about the efficiency, but whether you can do it, backgrounds. They acknowledge that it's very difficult. So people haven't really included this in any recent fits. Likewise, associated production, similar thing, but you have a dependence on the couplings, and you can, you know, it varies as a function of these E6 parameter, and then different models or different places on these parameter space, but it isn't, it's the ratios, it's Z prime W versus Z prime Z. Okay, so they did a similar fit. They used a different set of couplings and Petriello and Quackenbush, and they again seem to think you can distinguish between the models. This came from an old review. Okay, so now I get to my stuff in the last few minutes. So one of the things, you know, how do you identify these different models? How do you distinguish them? And one of the things that seems to be coming up a lot lately is that you can do some B tagging and top quark tagging to the point that somebody came. Aha, a friend of mine was at a Morion meeting last week, and he said, these guys at Atlas think you can do B physics at the LHC, like not LHC B, but actually one of the collider. And these guys have actually, on the Tevatron, they've done some phenomenal B physics. Like nobody would have expected that. So the idea is that when I showed you the repeated distribution, you're trying to distinguish between the up and the down, but it's really statistical and trying to fit stuff. But if you can actually measure the B final states and the top final states, that's additional information. So that's a basic idea that you have this tool, and possibly the C quarks, although we're trying to find out efficiencies and identification efficiencies, and it's not really clear. So what we were doing is using this property to distinguish between models. And the main issues are the identification efficiencies and the standard model backgrounds. So for B quarks, you know, we went through the literature, and typically the Atlas TDR gives an efficiency of 50% with high luminosity with a 100-to-1 rejection rate. What does that mean? Well, some of the time you produce a lot of light quark and gluon and jets coming from charm quarks that get misidentified, and you want to be able to reject that to a high degree. So they get 50% efficiency with a 100-to-1 rejection rate. And if you square this, if you require that you see both B quarks, so it reduces this to 0.25. You improve the rejection rate quite significantly. So this comes from a recent plot. There's an Atlas detector publication that came out recently. It's a bit different. So you can see if you want a 60% efficiency, you get actually here it's about 250 or something, 200 to 1 rejection rate. Okay, so that's the sort of numbers. What we did in our analysis, we went through the literature, we tried to figure out what they were doing, we spoke to experimentalists, we took a low efficiency and a high efficiency is bounding it. We argue, okay, we don't know what it is, but we'll just take this to demonstrate there's an existence proof that it's worth looking at. Top quarks are actually a lot worse. They decay to a B plus a W. The W can go to electron neutrino, well, electron neutrino or light quark, so you get this decay chain. Previously, it was felt that a single lepton, so one of the W goes to electron neutrino, and the other one goes to jets, was the cleanest signature, and it has a branching ratio of about 30%. And then if you go to CMS and PAPS, TDRs, and whatever they write, they've talked about 2 to 5%, but a more recent, I think it was an Atlas study, talks about a TT bar identification efficiency about 10%. Since then, there's been a few papers at least, people trying to be really clever. And they're starting to look at hadronic modes. And they somehow try to reconstruct a T to find it, but then to improve the likelihood they actually did it. So they combine jets to get some invariant, or some invariant mass, which should correspond to the T quark mass. But then they somehow break it up again to look at the properties, and they claim that that gives them a higher efficiency. And actually, a few people did similar ideas, maybe slightly different approaches at the same time. And clearly, hadronic modes have a higher branching ratio, so if you can use those, you can increase your overall efficiency quite substantially. So you have, the other thing is the efficiency varies with the PT going out. So that should be folded in, which we didn't fold in. Okay, so the QCD backgrounds. I think this is BD bar. That, again, these models, the invariant mass distribution for BB bar, and here's the QCD background. So really what you should do is put this on top of this. For these parts, it's down by orders of magnitude, so it won't add anything to it. So you're going to get this signal with a little blip on it. And the question is, can you do anything? It turns out that the PT distribution, the backgrounds have a much lower PT distribution, so if you put a fairly hard cut on the PD distribution of the jets, you can reduce the background quite significantly. The trick is you have a balance between improving the signal, the background versus cutting out too much of the signal. So if you have too hard a cut, you're starting to reduce some of your signal and you lose statistics. So you want to balance getting rid of the background versus improving without killing your statistics too much. So. This is with that cut that we've improved the signal to background a fair bit, and you can, obviously what you do is you put another cut on the invariant mass, because if you integrate over all of this, it's going to swamp it, but you just cut around the peak. And the result is actually fairly insensitive to what you use in here. We play with a bunch of things. Right? It's a very wide range.
Is there a lower limit on what sort of invariant mass binning you have at LHC, or is it just totally?
It's going to be dependent on the cuts they put in, and their cuts, ones they talk, they're like 50 GeV, or 20 GeV, 50 GeV of stuff coming out.
Put it where? Like a low-level transfer? What do you mean put it?
Oh, God. I don't know what level they put it in.
So they're encoding in somehow a binning into their triggering? Is that right?
You asked a question about how many events you get per crossing, right?
Yeah.
So, I forget, there's a large number per crossing.
Okay.
And most of it's complete crap. So you have to somehow remove, you can't take all that stuff in.
Yeah.
So you have to put some criteria, and basically the particle has less than a certain PT, it's hard to distinguish from everything else, so you just throw it away. And that's, I think, well, it's lower. It's actually, for some things it's 20, for some things it's 50, I don't remember what particles. So basically they have to put some cuts in.
Well, otherwise, it's a lower amount of the PT, though. I'm asking the, this binning here, for this, this distribution, is there some lower bound on basically the resolution of what you can see?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Where
the totally fine control.
How big a width they use. Yeah, there is.
When they measure a mass of a particle or the goes through the detector, there must be some.
They'll get folded into, because there'll be a bunch of them being combined to create this. So that's what I'm wondering, what is actual lower bound?
You're asking the bin size.
Like, is there any dangerous possibility that the bin size is typically bigger than these peaks in a bad way, and randomness comes along and gets in trouble?
Probably it's not randomness that's the problem, but you're right, it's a resolution, because if the peak is too narrow and then you have the number, you know, the area under the peak is going to be small, and you spread it out, you lose it. So, I don't know how small they go. I can, some tens, but I don't know if it's like 20 or 50.
Of GB.
Yeah. It might even make me 100, but I.
Okay, so if you want to see a peak, it has to have a width which is typically bigger than tens of GB. Is this the lesson?
No. Somebody asked me a related question.
I don't understand why
would it be because if you have a really narrow, basically the number of bins is integrating over the peak, right? And you have a really narrow peak, it just has less area, so there are fewer events. But then if your binning is a lot wider, those events get into a much, like the background is much bigger because it's a bigger log you're taking it out of. So then the number of events from the peak is just a small epsilon above the background. You have a narrow, if you can measure a narrow peak and the total number of background events is smaller, so a fewer events will be easier to see.
It's the same thing I was telling you about your signal in our conversation.
Okay, let me just
discuss that real quick.
Okay, so there are other issues about the face, which I sort of mentioned, but there are other standard model backgrounds that can be controlled, and again, this uncertainty is in the part on distribution functions. So what we did is, you can reduce the uncertainty in part on distributions by looking at some ratios, and then they cancel out in the ratios. The k-factor is the famous k-factor that includes QCD, and in this case, we're including electroweak corrections. So then the ratios just depend on these couplings. So it's another combination of couplings, but now we have B and T in them. So we can do something similar to what these other people did, and we can see what the models predict, and then calculate the ratio. So these error bars are based on, this is what we call the high efficiency one. So we take the efficiency for BB bar 50.5, and for TT bar is 0.1, and 100 inverse femtobarns and integrated luminosity. So you can use this to distinguish between models. It's fairly good. If you go from the high efficiency to the lower efficiency, and it's not so much the BB bar, because the error bars are still pretty much in control, but going from 10% to 1% efficiency for detecting TD bar pairs, the error bars become quite substantial. And in fact, if you look closely, we went from 110% of bars, which is sort of what they talk about, a year of running, to 300, which is a longer period. So again, though, you can distinguish, it's a discriminator between models. So, I mean, what we want ahead from this is we want to be able to see if we can do a fit to pull out each of those couplings somehow. That's would be the goal eventually. And then, these models have mixing angles. So in fact, we pick particular points, even the left, right, we pick some particular value of the mixing angle. So what happens if you vary it and you see certain parameter values from different models, you can't really distinguish. So you have the E6 model and the left-right symmetric model, their points that intersect. So if by some fluke you end up on one of those points, you can't use this to discriminate it. But of course, you have all those other observables, and you're using all of it to distinguish stuff. Okay, so just to summarize, S-channel resonances are predicted by many models of new physics. And it's quite possible that one might be discovered early in the LHC program in particular. The LHC can easily find a heavy Z prime-like state, but then the challenge is going to be to figure out what you're actually seeing. And there's a whole pile of observables that people have talked about in the past and use it to distinguish between these models. And one of the things we're looking at is trying to figure new ideas, because these ideas actually are, most of those other ones are 10 years old or longer, older. So the LHC coming on, you want to think harder to see if we can do better. And we think that using flavor tagging of third generation quarks can be a very useful way of distinguishing between models. And eventually what we want to do is be able to measure individual couplings. But in any case, the LHC era is hopefully going to be very exciting soon. Okay, thanks.
Is there any quick questions?
Quick questions. The little speaks, 27, 29, 3 parameters, and they're making the standard model, depending on whether you have the Iran or the Iraq neutrinos. Anyway, okay. The X have maybe 3 parameters on a lot.
Well, no, there is actually, I forget exactly, 2 or 3 additional parameters. You get the VEVs from these. When you break the global, there's like down to the next, and then another dev when you break to the standard model. And then depending on the model, you get mixing, one or two mixing.
T prime. So you presume you have to complete the T prime family.
No, that's true. Yeah, so
you can't just have a T prime thing, right? So.
No, they put into it depends on the model. And one of the you sound, you know, this better than I do.
I could start running the
models, but some of the models, they put them into triplets, and that's all they, so they just have one extra T prime and put the top, bottom, and a T prime, and there are other models that they have more extra particles.
Less than the MSSM. Far less than the MSSM.
The bar is lower than that.
So how long would the reason for the miscellaneous work, they've got a muon, Gibbs channel, cycle, how soon will they know that's there after they travel?
It'll be a function of the mass.
It's a triple peak
scenario.
Best case scenario. Say this is as light as you can live with.
Well, it's light as you can live with the trapping on, they've seen it already.
So it's just, yeah. So you're talking about 20. I'm asking, what's the early day point? When they tell you how long it's going to take to live, it's nice. You're often assuming what physics is and particular the
physics. Yeah.
But in your case, I think that would be the best case scenario, is how soon they could see it. So that would come down to how long it takes to down the
I don't think that's easy. I think it's probably the reason is because the new system is clean enough.
Yeah.
And they calibrate it. They've done some submission. So maybe you're saying, yeah, thanks.
And what's worse?
I don't know, 100 so far, it's gone beyond the entire problem, but I don't know how, once a month, if it's that 6 months or 8 months.
For more next year, is it something that's sort of less than
I don't think it'll be that light.
No, but if it was there, could they tell it that fast?
When are they finishing the run next year? Are they going October to October?
Yeah,
I heard that. So Morion, you're only halfway through the year, and they probably won't be very high luminosity 6 months from now. Yeah. So probably not. The summer conferences, possibly. Okay, that's good. So just when static was finished, I have to find.
When is the PDF calibration planning to happen?
I don't know. I didn't say. I sort of that's something they I mean, people, I don't know specifically, people in, you know, collaborations and some groups are working on it. But these big collaborations, everybody wants to grab different pieces and people want, you know, everybody wants to discover the hits. And I don't know who's working on this, you know, on this stuff.
It's not sexy.
Exactly. The people at Carleton, some of them are interested in top quark physics because they figured you're going to produce a lot of top quarks very quickly. So you can do a lot of interesting top quark physics early in the LHC program. That's not QCD. I don't know who's work. I don't know.
Cool. Thanks, Steve, one more time.